The old chaos that devoured the once proud Ivory King, and the profaned flame that lit the sky ablaze. Could they be one and the same? Is not chaos itself profane in nature? Did the flame continue to burn on the same tract of land, subjugating the people nearby and forcing its leaders to attempt to hide it from the world? Most notably, the Ivory King and Lady Alsana. Was it not the sisters of this silent oracle that triggered the curse of this flame? The old chaos beneath the Laem Lois is an interesting mystery indeed. And the more I looked into it, the more of a conundrum it became. It's certainly a reference to the Flame of Chaos, but is it the Flame of Chaos? Or perhaps a different but similar flame altogether? That was the real question I needed answered. But the answer that I've come up with is that I'm still not sure. You see, the handful of descriptions from armor sets and the Ivory King's soul and weapon in Dark Souls 2, more often than not, the C in Chaos is not capitalized when talking about the chaos the Lois Knights plunged into. Which is confusing, because an unruly flame would be chaotic, and plunging into it would be plunging into chaos. But chaos capitalized would be more specific to the actual Flame of Chaos. So you can see the conundrum there. And that's not to mention the idea that the Flame of Chaos originated in Izalith. How far can a flame really travel? And other questions of that nature. So what I concluded was, what is known as the Flame of Chaos and the Profaned Flame could be synonymous. Profane is defined as something secular or non-religious, which is exactly what the Flame of Chaos would be considered within the universe of Dark Souls. The sins of Izalith are brought up repeatedly, and the twisted, malformed creatures imposed upon the world from its flames are, at least in the grand scheme of things, unholy. So perhaps it is its own piece of the Flame of Chaos distorted even further. The axe, Eleonora reads, a strange weapon found among the malformed inhabitants of the profaned capital. The profaned flame was triggered by the curse of these women, relatives of a certain oracle. But despite their culpability, they went on living without any cares. The only named oracle in Dark Souls is Alsana, and is who I think the description has to be talking about. When Manus was killed, he was shattered into tiny pieces, which would give birth to particular beings that inhabited Manus's emotions. These shards would go on seeking power and ruin, manipulating kings to their dark will, and putting kingdoms to disarray. Alsana was, for the most part, the exception to her fragment sisters. She was the manifestation of Manus's fear, and latched onto the Ivory King for the comfort his power brought her. She would later realize that this king knew this and cared for her all the same. So thus, Alsana sits in watch over the chaos that her king failed to defeat, selflessly for her king. Quite the opposite that we see from her sisters. So the profaned flame was triggered by the relatives of a certain oracle, that oracle being Alsana. The relatives being the other shards of Manus. Look at the enemy that drops Eleonora. It's called the Monstrosity of Sin, and it's literally a giant hand monster. And Manus literally means hand. And it was his giant hand that pulled the chosen undead into the past, which inevitably spelled his demise. The symbolism is all there. But why would a shard of Manus trigger this chaotic and profaned flame? The Ivory King Ultra Greatsword reads, "It is said that the Ivory King was once the highest ranking knight in his home of Ferosa, famed for its god of war. After taking his crown, they say he was the first to swing his sword in times of need, be it for his homeland or his people." The Ferosa part is interesting because it is known for its god of war, which we know to be the firstborn of Lord Gwyn, which probably means that Eleam Lois, ruled by the former highest-ranking knight of Ferosa, likely would have sided with the tradition of linking the fire and extending its age. Eleam Lois definitely has its connections to Ferosa, more so than just its king. It's also intriguing to consider the description of the North Warder robes found within Frozum Eleam Lois. It reads, "Ferosans venerated the god of war, and sages who led warriors into battle were called North Warders. North Warders earned their title only after completing a great journey of great hardship, after which they would be worshipped as oracles of war gods." Now again, Alsanna is the only named oracle we know of, which isn't to say necessarily that she led Knights of Lois into battle to earn this title. Perhaps being close to the king had its benefits, and she earned the title a different way. But that isn't really important. I draw from this that as time went on, Alsanna was the one shard of Manus who forsook her purpose in a way. Instead, she cared for her king and her people. Again, the direct opposite of the other shards. And in doing so, it seems stood behind the ideologies of Lois and Ferosa, which is also the direct opposite of the darkness sought by the other shards. The reason I explain all of this is because I think that is the reason the profane flame was triggered by Alsanna's sisters. Because she found and or achieved what they didn't. Call it anger, jealousy, whatever. But I think it was a vengeful act in spite of Alsanna. Now that's all well and interesting, but it doesn't quite draw all the parallels of the profaned flame and the old chaos being the same. That would mean that the profaned capital was built on the remains of Eleam Lois, and I think there may be some evidence of that. The profaned capital certainly has its ties to Dark Souls 2, which we can start looking no further than the corpse of poor Laddersmith Gilligan. Then there's obviously the Axe Eleonora, which is in reference to the Shards of Manus. The Oni Slayer Greatbow, which is the Alon Greatbow. And if you buy into the idea that Carla is also a shard of Manus, then she's just on the outskirts of the profaned capital in Irithyll Dungeon. There's even Yorm the Giant, which I believe is the biggest tie into Dark Souls 2. His soul reads, "Yorm is the descendant of an ancient conqueror, but was asked by the very people once subjugated to lead them, serving as both a weighty blade and a stone-hard shield. I believe the ancient conqueror Yorm descended from, to be the very giant lord who invaded and conquered Drangleic in retaliation for Vindrick stealing from the giants and enslaving them. Asked by the people once subjugated, could be in reference to the fact that giants were slaves in Drangleic, but eventually the people needed Yorm's strength. And more specifically, they needed it against the profaned flame. Perhaps because after the Ivory King's demise, the flame could be left unchecked. And of course, we know Yorm tried to fight fire with fire, as his cinders read. Cinders of a lord left by Yorm the Giant. Lonely Yorm became a lord of cinder to put the profaned flame to rest, knowing full well that those who spoke of him as lord were quite insincere. Of course, that didn't work out so well for the denizens around the flame. But by now, we of course know that being in proximity to any sort of named flame in Dark Souls is probably just a bad idea. The profaned flame pyromancy reads, the profaned capital was consumed by fire after Yorm the Giant became a Lord of Cinder. The fire, born of the sky, is said to have incinerated naught but human flesh. That is, of course, expected because we knew from the beginning that the flame itself was triggered by a curse. So naturally, things wouldn't have gone as expected. We also know that the old chaos was down below the frozen township of Alayim Lois, almost in the same manner that the profaned capital is down below the frozen township of Irithyll. The profaned greatsword reads, a ceremonial sword held in Pontiff Sullivan's right hand, representing the profaned flame. Long ago, when Sullivan was yet a young sorcerer, he discovered the profaned capital and an unfading flame below a distant tundra of Irithyll, and a burning ambition took root within him. An unending flame below a frozen landscape sounds exactly like Alayim Lois. In fact, a lot of things about Pontiff are kind of reminiscent some of the traditions that came out of Alayim Lois. Take, for example, Sullivan being a sorcerer, which could be in reference to the sorcerers we see in the profaned capital. The court sorcerer's robes read, robe worn by court sorcerers of the profaned capital. The formal gold stitching suggests they may have also been oracles. There are many sorcerers who claim heirship to the great sage Big Hat Logan. The profaned capital houses one of two leading schools. Now, I'm not going to get started on how Logan might be included in the profaned capital or flame, because it'd be a deep rabbit hole to traverse. But I don't think it's particularly important to this theory. It is interesting, however, the idea that the court sorcerers could possibly be oracles as well, which could allude back to the sages at Alayim Lois becoming oracles. There also seems to be a similarity in designs between the Lois Knight armor set and Sullivan's Outrider Knights, as well as similarities between those who inhabit the two armors. Let's read their descriptions. The charred Lois armor reads, these knights of Lois plunged into the old chaos with their lord and lost their sense of self. To this day, they still burn in agony alongside their once proud king. And the Outrider Knight armor reads, the knights were given the eyes of the Pontiff, but the eyes transformed them into savage, raving warriors who only knew how to serve as mindless guards. So, not exactly the same, but but the outcomes are similar. Losing your sense of self and mindlessly attacking. But that, of course, isn't an uncommon theme in Dark Souls. I do want to point out the Pontiff's use of eyes to constantly hound his knights, especially considering Alayam Lois also placed importance on the eyes of their priestesses. The Eye of the Priestess reads, "The eye of the first priestess who watched over Alayam Lois allows one to see the unseen. All the great priestesses replaced one of their birth eyes with this, returning it after their term was complete. The tradition of using eyes to watch over certain aspects of their kingdom, to help keep locked away the flame, could be where Sullivan derived his use of eyes within his own people. Finally, let's take a look at the vessel shield. Its description reads, shield depicting a priestess of Alayam Lois. The priestess, who devoted themselves to appeasing the ancient flame, are no longer. Now, a reason they could be no longer is that Alayam Lois itself is no longer, or their hearts were turned by the profaned flame. But if we look at the shield itself, the priestess watching over the flame inside some sort of goblet-like vessel, or kind of like its own lord vessel, if you will. Not unlike what these seemingly priestesses are doing with a flame at the profane capital. I think all of the would-be coincidences between Alayam Lois and the profaned capital / Irithyll are too many to be nothing. Stranger, are you now prepared to plunge into chaos? Long ago, when the Millwood Knights lost the forest they called home, they began a journey so long that even thoughts of their sworn enemy washed away, replaced by a vision of a cold and brittle wood. Let's start with learning what we can about Millwood. Varying item descriptions describe it as a forest of primitive earth worship, where its knights fought hand in hand with the earth, even fighting alongside wolf companions. Some of these knights' weapons were even made up of that very earth, but what many of their weapons share in common is being blessed by a symbol of the ethereal oak. An oak that stood at the very heart of their forest, and presumably magic in nature. These weapons were used in their fight against their sworn enemy, the Abyss Dragon. But eventually it seems that they failed in their duty and lost their forest home to this dragon. And as they began to wander, they became more and more forlorn. Until one day, these knights took up a new home within the painted world of Ariandel. And when the Millwood Forest was once again rediscovered, it was found as a vacant ruin, save for the rotting ethereal orc. No corpses were found either. Yet their belongings were laid neatly upon the ground. As previously stated, the story of Millwood is quite enigmatic and interesting nonetheless. But it did leave a few things worth pondering on in relation to some of the other things we've encountered in the world of Dark Souls. Initially, I thought their sworn enemy, the Abyss Dragon, could have been Medir, as he's tasked with fighting the Abyss. And as far as we know, the only dragon to do so. But the more I thought about it, the less sense it made. Medir fought the Abyss. It doesn't seem like Millwood had anything to do with the Abyss, outside of fighting the Abyss Dragon. It seems unlikely Madeir would just wage war with a civilization, with a seemingly magical force that has nothing to do with the Abyss, for no reason. The only other dragon I could think of that might fit this bill is Calamite. Now, the very little item descriptions about Calamite don't mention if he has anything to do with the Abyss, just that he brings calamity, and that his tail is apparently made of obsidian. But it is worth noting that he obviously is found around Ulysseal, where the Abyss started. And when he breathes his fire, some of it is black. And of course, we know that the Abyss can produce a black flame. So keep that in mind as we go on. The idea I want to present to you is, what if Millwood was the precursor for another civilization? Or more specifically, is it possible that Millwood was the precursor of Ulysseal? Someone had to discover the vacant Millwood, and what if they decided to build upon it? Let's look at some of the similarities between Millwood and Ulysseal. They're both seemingly magical forests with strong ties to nature. Between using weapons made of earth, to fighting alongside wolves, to getting mentored by giant talking mushrooms. Millwood's ethereal oak is also quite interesting, especially considering the magical white birch that hails from Ulysseal. Both magical trees with magical properties. What's more is that the captain's ashes, which allow us to buy the Millwood items, depict a hand holding either a branch or a root of the ethereal oak. And it's the same white as the white birch. Maybe that's coincidence, or maybe this particular forest produces white magical trees. The protectors of Ulysseal are made up of stone and fight hand in hand with the earth, just as the Millwood Knights were fabled to. Even their weapons art is similar to that of the Millwood weapons, shattering the earth and launching it at their opponents. Ulysseal is also renowned for its golden light sorceries, which if I were to think of another word to describe them, it'd likely be ethereal. Then there's Calamite. If he is the Abyss Dragon that was the sworn enemy of the Millwood Knights, and what was eventually forced them from their homes, then I think it makes a lot of sense that Calamite is back here at Ulysseal as the Abyss is consuming it, as things in Dark Souls often come back full circle. So, was the grand city of Ulysseal built upon the ruins of Millwood within the magical woods that encompassed them both? Using the earth for protection, respecting the power it could harbor, and wielding the magical properties in the trees of this region. It's hard to say for sure, but as is the case for Dark Souls, it's up to the individual to decide how they believe the story played out. I believe that Manus and Dusk were in love. Or that Manus was infatuated and obsessed with Princess Dusk. I believe the Ringed City DLC sheds quite a bit of light upon this. The white birch bow description reads, a short bow crafted with white birch, endowed with light manipulating magic. The bow is a relic from the land of an old sorcerer who was swallowed by the Abyss, and known for his role in the heroic tale of the Abyss Walker. With this description, we can easily assume it is about Manus. The old sorcerer who was swallowed by the Abyss was actually from Ulysseal, which is definitely interesting, and would make sense as to why he made his grave there. Let's read the antiquated plain Set's description. ordinary garb from an ancient land of sorcery. The gold embellishments betray a faint residue of magic, but this clothing was never intended for battle. When a mission visited the Ringed City long ago, one of its younger missionaries elected to stay behind. It was who he became the last recorded spear of the church. So this is obviously referencing Ulysseo. And this is the garb that we find Half-Light wearing. So here is what I'm thinking. A. Half-Light is Manus. B. Half-Light is Manus's son. And I'm leaning more towards the former. Now, just hear me out. Half-Life couldn't be Manus. Manus is dead and a beast. Loud and clear. But remember, time is super convoluted in Dark Souls. I mean, we time hop like twice in the Ringed City itself. Solaire himself said, heroes centuries old phasing in and out. And we see Half-Light is specifically summoned to the fight. So according to the laws of physics and time and gravity that Dark Souls does not follow, having Manus summoned into a fight pre-Beast is certainly a real possibility. Now, that's obviously not nearly enough for me to sell you on him being Half-Light, so let's continue. There's something specific that stood out to me on the antiquated plane set, which is from Ulysseo, and we can now deduct Manus was also a sorcerer from Ulysseo. But the set brandishes a stone pendant, and if we take a closer look at it, we see a simple oval-shaped stone wrapped in either string or vine. And vine could make more sense here, since it's from Ulysseo. But that may just be my wishful thinking. So let's read the description of Manus's precious broken pendant. It reads, half of a broken stone pendant. The vine appears to originate from Ulysseo. A powerful magic can be sensed from this ancient stone. Yet men of this time can neither manipulate nor sense its power, which has a distinct air consisting of both reverence and nostalgia. A stone pendant already explains exactly what we see around Half-Light's neck. Looking at the image of the broken pendant, we can immediately see that the half remaining looks like if it were whole, we'd have an oval stone pendant wrapped in a similar manner as Half-Light's, which just can't be coincidence. The broken pendant stated that it had a distinct air of reverence, which basically means a deep respect for something or someone. Which makes me think of Manus and the mission he traveled to the Ringed City with, and ended up choosing to stay behind to serve something greater than himself. So my two guesses on the pendant's origins is that he received it for going above and beyond from his fellow missionaries, or it could have been some trinket from Dusk or associated with her. I mean, he went crazy furiously searching for it. It's of the utmost importance to this guy. Something else I found interesting is that Half-Light is using a version of some sort of homing soul mass spell that we haven't seen. It's made up of golden lights, which is what the magic of Ulysseo is known for. But what's curious is that we can trade the soul of Manus to Snuggly the Crow to receive the other unique homing soul mass spell, Pursuers. Which, if Half-Light commanded this weapon and went on to become Manus, it would make sense to see why this spell would also become abyss-tainted. It also makes sense that Manus's name would not have always been Manus. Manus is Latin for hand, which correlates with, well, his gigantic hand. Also interesting is that Half-Light means dim light, such as at dusk. So we see here that the definition could be a play on words. It could also be foreshadowing Manus' own downfall. He tried to do good, but eventually would become overcome by the dark, hence Half-Light. We also see Half-Light wield the white birch bow, which the description states specifically belonged to who we can only assume is Manus. Then we have Manus kidnapping Dusk and taking her to the Abyss. After we defeat him, we find Dusk on the ground, unharmed, and she eventually gets herself to safety. I think it is a safe assumption that Manus did not intend to harm her. It would have been way too easy for him to do so. Picture, if you will, a King Kong situation. A huge, terrifying, and horribly misunderstood creature, infatuated with a woman who he couldn't have, in a world that just didn't understand him. I think the same principles can be applied to this story. And if Manus was Half-Light before, it would make sense that Dusk didn't recognize what he had become, as she never mentions having knowing him or who he was before. She does say, though, that she could feel the emotions surrounding the beast. I like to think they were both in love, though. It's a little happy for what Dark Souls is accustomed to, but I like that ray of light cast before the tale of Manus takes its tragic plunge into the dark. I also like to think that when Dusk was first captured and taken into the far future, and held inside the golden crystal golem, assumingly by Seath, that this is what could have caused Manus, or Half-Life, to abandon his post and go into his emotion-filled depression, as is the nature of man, and what ultimately drove him to lay himself to rest in his own grave. As we know, the primeval man, under the curse of Gwyn's undeath, couldn't actually die. Until Koth got the people of Ulusil to poke and prod the poor lad until he snapped. Then, finding Dusk was back, he brings her to him in the Abyss, but by then it was far too late for a happy ending. It's also interesting to think that we find Manus' broken pendant on a crystal golem in the Duke's archives, which are directly related to Dusk going missing in the first place. So perhaps Manus gave the pendant to Dusk as a symbol of their love, and it was shattered when she was kidnapped, and he may have thought she was dead or lost to him, and furiously sought after his precious pendant. For if he could find it, maybe he'd find her. Another random tidbit, which likely is just more wishful thinking on my part, but is still interesting nonetheless, is that one of the etymologies for the word Manus means branch of a tree, which made me think of the young white branch from Ulusil, which we know is the product of Dusk's first sorcerer staff. I also mulled over the idea that Half-Light could be the son of Manus and Dusk. It's all in the name there. Half-Light is kind of exactly the name you'd give the kid of Manus and Dusk. A dim light, such as Dusk, half good, half dark. The pendant could have been some sort of family heirloom or family crest-like thing. But I just feel like if Dusk had had a son, she or Lisbeth probably would have mentioned it. The only way I see around it could be that he was conceived when Dusk was taken to the Abyss. But I don't know. It seems much more likely that Half-Light is who Manus was before the dark took root. In order to tell you about Farron's Legion, we need to go all the way back to the beginning. Back to Knight Artorias. Of course, if you know anything about Dark Souls, then you've heard the tales of brave Artorias the Abysswalker. The hero who fought and traversed the Abyss to save Ulusil and the world. But it wasn't really that simple. And it wasn't really Artorias. In fact, it was us, or the Chosen Undead, who accomplished the great deeds. But it was Artorias' name that would be forerun through these tales. For good reason, though. The world needed the name and face of a hero. The world needed an example. And that example would be the very foundation that Farron's Legion was built upon. Now, Artorias didn't just become the Abysswalker through acts of grandeur. No, his ability to freely traverse the Abyss was bought with a price. The Covenant of Artorias reads, "This ring symbolizes Knight Artorias' covenant with the beasts of the Abyss. Its wearer, like Artorias himself, can traverse the Abyss." So it was a pact made with the beasts of the Abyss that allowed Artorias to walk it. Now, I've often pondered on who these beasts of the Abyss were. The Abyss has been around for a long time, and I never thought it was the tainted beasts of the Abyss that made a pact with Artorias, the one person in the world slaughtering their kind. I don't think it makes sense for them to give their enemy the ability to come into their home and destroy them. Then I thought, maybe it was Koth. He dwells in the Abyss, and is always up to his primordial serpent manipulative ways. He could have given Artorias his ability. But that still didn't quite add up to me. Because again, Artorias was constantly hunting down Koth's dark wraiths and killing them. And sure, maybe he eventually knew that Artorias would succumb to the Abyss and wanted to streamline the process. It's a possibility, I suppose. But not every creature or beast we see in the Abyss was evil or corrupted. In fact, we even see a good friend of Artorias there, and they even lead us to the stranded Sif. The Cat Covenant ring reads, "Ring granted to those bound by the Forest Hunter Covenant. The white cat Alvina speaks a human tongue and has lived since the early Age of Fire. Alvina was a trusted friend of Knight Artorias and the Great Wolf Sif." Now, there isn't a specific requirement known that makes a creature or beast of the Abyss. But I imagine being able to be in it is likely a prerequisite. So wouldn't it make more sense that Artorias' covenant was built upon a pact made with a trusted friend, as opposed to his enemies? Now, this seems like a rabbit hole of sorts, but Alvina's Forest Hunter Covenant is important because it as well shares the same principles as Farron's Legion. The Forest Hunters protect Artorias' grave and the surrounding forest graves from intruders. Alvina even claims that those in the Covenant must heed the Golden Rule, that the clan is family, and to your kinsmen you must forever remain loyal. And so, when the forest and the resting spots of its heroes are threatened, those in the Forest Hunter's clan are summoned to defend it. The Watchdogs of Farron sigil reads, "Ancient medallion depicting the crest of a wolf symbolizes the pact with the Old Wolf of Farron. The Watchdogs ensure that the warriors sleep in serenity by taking the form of loyal spirits and hunting down those who would trespass the woods of Farron." The parallels are quite apparent, and it's certainly more interesting while entertaining the idea that Alvina granted Artorias the ability to walk in the Abyss. Which means Alvina laid the foundation for everything that Farron's Legion is. Also consider this. While the item description describes Alvina as a white cat, we can see that she's clearly more gray-colored or iron-colored. Which is fun, because the name Farron is a name of Anglo-Saxon origin, and came from the given name, Fairmund. The surname Farron originally derived from the old French word ferrant, which meant iron gray. But do with that random factoid what you will. It is mostly common knowledge now that Darkroot Garden and Basin in Dark Souls 1 are the remains of ancient Ulysium. I won't delve too deeply into it here, but if you're not already convinced, just see the architecture, map design, and the stone guardians to help get you there. Now, consider the idea that even the area of Farron's Keep is built upon ancient Ulysio / the Darkroot Garden. What's most interesting about the idea is that everything has taken place on these grounds. From Artorias' grave, to the forest hunters protecting the land and graves, to the watchdogs of Farron protecting the same land and same graves. It's like we were watching an idea that continued to grow in shape, essentially what was the legend of Artorias. People often assume that Farron's legion simply consisted of the Abyss Watchers, but that's not the case. It was actually quite a large entity of people. Though, to be fair, the Abyss Watchers were easily their most formidable warriors, and those most connected with the blood that connected them all, and likely the face of the Legion. The soul of the Blood of the Wolf, which is dropped by the Abyss Watchers, reads, "Soul of the Blood of the Wolf. The blood was spread amongst the Abyss Watchers, and their souls are one with the soul of the Wolf Blood Master." Now, this almost portrays the Abyss Watchers as some sort of hive-minded group, but that's a completely different topic for a completely different day. But they bore the legacy with the Wolf Blood Master, and not only share this bond in blood, but share its soul. You already are likely thinking that Artorias is the Wolfmaster, and you'd be correct. But let's go ahead and confirm it anyway. The Wolf Knight's greatsword, transposed from the soul of the Blood of the Wolf, reads, "Greatsword of a knight tainted by the dark of the abyss, and master of the wolf's blood of Farron." The Wolf Knight was the first Abyss Watcher, and his sword is more punishing against creations of the Abyss. The sword quite obviously belongs to Artorias. But for the sake of clarity, we'll also read the description of Artorias' armor, which is called the Wolf Knight set in Dark Souls 3. As it seems, Wolf Knight is Artorias' new moniker. What's also interesting is that you can only buy this armor set in the Untended Graves after you've defeated the Abyss Watchers. I don't think there's any secret meaning to this, but the darkened fire link is, I guess, symbolic of the dark of the Abyss. Anyway, the Wolf Knight helm reads, "Helm of a knight tainted by the dark of the Abyss. The twilight blue tassel is damp, and will remain ever so. A vanquished knight left behind only wolf's blood, and a duty of legacy. The undead legion of Farron was formed to bear his torch, and the armor of the Abyss Watchers suggests their own eventual end." So clearly the Wolf Master is Artorias. But what of the wolf's blood he left behind? Obviously, he wasn't a wolf, but he did have his companion Sif, the Great Grey Wolf, at his side at all times. And as it so happens, Sif was the only thing Artorias actually left behind. Artorias' shield, the Cleansing Great Shield, reads, "The steel great shield used by the knight who succumbed to the abyss. Artorias, deeply scarred by the abyss, used this to form a barrier to protect his compatriot Sif." So Sif's blood is the blood that Artorias, the Wolfmaster, left behind. And so while Farron's legion was formed to continue Artorias' legacy, They built it upon Sif's blood. Now, that's not to say they went and slaughtered the wolf for her blood. But it is canonical that the chosen undead slays Sif to retrieve the covenant of Artorias. So it's likely that, especially considering how close to all of this Alvina and her forest hunters were. And not just close ideologically, but physically close, that they went to Sif's corpse and collected her blood. I'm not entirely sure how they used the blood to connect their souls, but I'm going to assume some sort of magic. As I said earlier, Farron's Legion wasn't just comprised of the Abyss Watchers. No, it was a mass of people, likely from all different backgrounds and nations, brought together in a singular cause. The majority were probably from Ulysseal, given the location, and the fact that they had a front row seat to the destruction of their home. But the influence of Farron's Legion reached far and wide. In fact, they even boasted a powerful sorcerer. The Crystal Hail sorcery description reads, "Unique sorcery developed by extraordinary preacher twins known as the Crystal Sages. In a pact said to have been formed long ago, one of the sages allied with the Undead Legion in order to train the sorcerers of Farron. The Crystal Sages were even the successors of the Great Big Hat Logan, one of the most prolific sorcerers of all time. And one of these Crystal Sages went on to tutor the Legion and their sorcerers to further strengthen their arsenal against the Abyss. The sage would develop and refine several sorceries specifically for the Legion and compile them into the Sage's Scroll, including the Farron Hail sorcery, which was initially created by the daughter of the leader of the Legion's acolytes, the Xanthus scholar Hazel. But still, the Legion wasn't just Abyss Watchers and wizards. It boasted many warriors, including the people who would one day become the corrupted Grues we see within the Festering Woods. The Rotten Grue Dagger reads, "Choice weapon of the blunt-horned Grues, descendants of the acolytes of Farron Keep. The rancid blade is drenched in rotten waste, making it acutely poisonous." Now, I'm not certain in what exact manner the Grues are corrupted. There could be an argument made that they look similar to the Abyss-corrupted bloatheads we see in Ulysseal. Or perhaps they became corrupted when the wolf's blood dried up and the woods began to fester. But corrupted or not, it seems that not even their duty or loyalty has wavered, as they still defend their home, and would seemingly still fight against the Abyss. And I think further evidence of this is the Grue barring the way to the Abyss Watchers against the Dark Wraiths, who were Artorias' prey and mortal enemy. So I imagine there was no love lost between the two groups over the centuries. But that still isn't all of the people comprising of Farron's Legion. Their followers had followers. And by that, I mean the Farron followers. The follower armor says, "Armor worn by the Farron followers. When a warrior of Farron fell to the Abyss, the tall, lean followers, with their hollowed eyes, quietly appeared in groups to hunt them down. Farron and its watchers fell to ruin, but the followers survived as a wandering pack of hollows." So dedicated was the fight against the Abyss, there was a unit comprised of those who would hunt down their own kin who had fallen to the Abyss. It's even said that their sword technique was honed to fight against men, implying that those who had yet to lose their humanity to the Abyss were their likeliest prey, which is pretty hardcore. But that's what the Legion was all about. A no-nonsense abyss-fighting force. Even Hawkwood, the Legion's deserter, says this about the Legion. The Undead Legion of Faerun is a caravan of undead, sworn by the wolf's blood to contain the abyss. The Legion will bury a kingdom at the first sign of exposure. Joyous bunch, really. That might also be literal. Faerun's keep is quite literally on top of the catacombs of Carthus. Now, catacombs are underground anyway, but there still isn't a trace of their kingdom above it. We know that Wolnir was a mighty king, and he and his kingdom of Carthus eventually fell to the abyss. This battle could have been what finally did Faerun's legion in. They knew their end was eventual, and they'd be corrupted one day. So the two groups extinguished each other, it seems. But before the wolf's blood could dry completely, the Watchers used it as their mandate to serve his lord, and lit the first flame anew. It was then that the Faerun followers, with no one left from the Legion to hunt down, lost their duty, and were slowly drawn into the world of the Forlorn. But the Age of Fire would continue to dwindle, and one day the bells would toll. The Undead Legion would arise once more as Lords of Cinder, but they would forsake their duty to the Flame, for that is not and never was their true duty. Their mission, their life's work, is to fight and eradicate any signs of the abyss, even if it meant each other. So here we find the Abyss Watchers, locked within Faerun's keep, mindless undead faltering in their duty. So one by one they slay each other, because just like Artorias, these abyss-fighting heroes have nary a murmur of dark. And so locked in eternal battle to rid one another of their corruption, they fight unending.